Hello, and welcome to episode 211 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Today's episode marks the start of an occasional series we'll be producing now through the rest of the year, inspired by Rick's lecture series, The Search for Meaning. We'll begin with a theme of truth today, not as an abstract idea, but as something that shapes public trust, everyday decisions, and how we live our lives. Rick, I know your first lecture series here in the city of La Crosse was held last night, and in this series called The Search for Meaning, you started off talking about truth. And for listeners here, I was hoping you could tell us a bit more about the series and if it was intentional that you started with truth.
Well, it was intentional that I started with truth. The series is called The Search for Meaning, and it's really it's a seven-part series. I'm going to do a lecture every 2 weeks.
And for those in the La Crosse area, they can show up, or for those who are not in the La Crosse area, they can fly in and show up.
Yeah, and well, we're also recording them, and we'll be putting them on the Ethics Institute's YouTube channel. So
you don't even have to fly in.
You don't even have to fly in, yeah. You know, I've been fascinated and disturbed by what I'm seeing going on at universities is that so much of the kind of classical education that I received in the liberal arts tradition just isn't present at most universities anymore. And it's not that I think all students should have like a really firm grounding in philosophy, but I think there are certain ideas that are important to know something about. And I'm just giving a public lecture series, kind of an introduction to the ideas that I think are central to us having a sense of meaning in our lives, that the ideas of truth, goodness, love, beauty, justice, nature, and the soul.
And again, for listeners, we'll touch on, over the next couple of months, all of those topics kind of individually. I should tell you, I haven't told you this yet, but I had a commitment last night, but I do hope to make one or two of these as the series rolls out here in La Crosse. But what was... Maybe you can start talking a little, and also I should point out at the beginning that you're writing columns that will sort of mirror this rollout that we'll link to in the show notes and have available as we do always on Lee newspaper sites. But you started with truth, and does that sort of underpin all of the other topics you're talking about? Is that sort of why you started there?
Yeah, it's truth is foundational both to our personal lives. We're having, say, a life of integrity. And what I started out with is the ancient Greek maxim to know yourself. Like and Socrates' insistence that the only way you know yourself is to open yourself up to questioning by others and participate in this give and take of discussion in which you both question others, and you are willing to be questioned about your most sincerely held beliefs and views about the world. We're living in an age where it's becoming increasingly easy just to select the kind of audience that we interact with. And so that makes us more polarized, but it also makes us much more susceptible to misinformation. And I think misinformation is a real danger for democracies. I'm trying to take some what I think like kind of ancient classical ideas that are kind of at the foundation of our understanding of humanity, but also show how they're really relevant to how we live today.
And we'll get to some of these ancient teachings in a moment, but in the column that you wrote, again, based on this topic of truth, you started off not talking about an ancient subject. You started off talking about something that was in the news just, I think, last week.
Yeah, I started out talking about what happened at the hearings of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And I think it was the Senate Finance Committee held a hearing looking at what's going on with the turmoil within the CDC. And as we know, like the director of the CDC was fired and several top people there resigned in protest. But it's not just that there's a disagreement over leadership of the CDC. There's fundamental disagreements about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. This is a fascinating thing because normally what we do is in a society, we say, well, this is a scientific matter. We'll trust those who are doing research in it to do the research and then let us know, like, are they safe? Are they effective? And we want the appropriate regulatory bodies to use the evidence to look at that. But we've got powerful people insisting that they know the answers to these complicated questions that disagree completely and foundationally all the way down on everything. And this really affects people who are just trying to live their lives or trying to do their job, you know, like parents who want to know, should I have my children get a vaccine? Should I try to get a flu vaccine or a COVID vaccine this fall? And then how do I do it? People don't know. And we don't. What was really amazing in these Senate hearings is you have a senator saying people can't get the COVID vaccine. And Kennedy just says, you're wrong. They can get it. That's a claim about fact.
Mm-hmm.
We should be able to figure out, like, who's telling the truth, who's right, and we can't do it. This is a real problem for any society, but especially a democracy in which we have responsibility for electing our officials, the people who represent us, and we do it on the basis of determining, are they doing a good job? Are they doing what they say they will do, and are they leading us in the right direction? And people don't know who to believe and what to think about fundamental things. So I just pose this as, like, this is why this is not just a problem of what we call misinformation, right? This is a problem, like, we no longer can agree on what truth is and how to determine the truth.
And my take on at least a portion of this is that the CDC is just one of but many institutions that have, I think it's right to question these institutions, don't get me wrong, but I think have really come under fire, and people who really don't think the people who run these institutions, and that can be, you know, mainstream media, it can be organizations like the CDC, it can be any of, you know, local governments, all these things, that the people who are not elected leaders, but people who are running these agencies, who are making key decisions, are not acting on good faith, that they're acting either for their personal purposes or under some political pressure that steers their decisions one way or the other. And I think that that's something that I don't know how we reverse that, but I think it's in some ways kind of critical that we do, right? Because so many people, and we heard this so much around when COVID was at its worst, when all these recommendations were coming out. And again, not every recommendation was rock solid, great, but you had people, in my opinion, doing their best to provide sound, good advice in a moment when the future was a little uncertain. And you had people saying, well, you know, I'm going to do my own research. And of course, that just meant Googling around and trying to find headlines on news stories or even propaganda that matched what they already believe.
Because 99.9% of us don't have the means of doing actual research on mRNA vaccines.
Exactly. Right? Like, I mean, like, you know, if you had some existential failure in your home of your electrical system, like the fuse box starts sparking and you have no power, you probably could go onto a YouTube page and, like, maybe figure it out. But I think you and most people would be like, no, this seems really bad. I'm going to call an electrician who has that expertise that 99.5% of Americans don't have. And that's, like, the right call.
Yes. And that is relatively simple.
Yeah,
compared to the way vaccines work.
Yeah,
right?
That's true as well. Yeah, I mean, electricity is dangerous and complicated, but not, like, ridiculously complicated.
Here's a I've been concerned, as you have, many people in our country have been concerned about the growing distrust of institutions and the increase of misinformation and propaganda within our society. However, I think we've reached a point now where there aren't simple fixes to this. And I think the problem isn't just that we have some rogue officials who are kind of using their positions of power for personal ambition, because that's always happened. The corrective to that is that we used to have a public who, for the most part, cared about what was true, and cared about what was true and what was actually happening more than they cared just about their loyalty to, say, a political party. And I don't think that's the case anymore. So I think the problem goes all the way down into the American character. And I think that's where we have to look for solutions, not just in like who's producing the misinformation and like who should be running these institutions. I think it's who are we? How are we educating our kids? And are we bringing up people to be comfortable with questioning and being questioned? And that's why in the column I bring up the life of Socrates, who in defending his way of life, this is Plato's famous dialogue called The Apology, which as when Socrates is on trial, he defends his way of life in the course of this trial. He doesn't just say the charges are false. What he says is that he's committed to questioning everybody he meets about whether they're living the best possible life, because this is the best thing we can do. This is a worthwhile way to spend one's life, is questioning and being questioned. And that's because as human beings, we have such a bias towards self-deception. And
that's not new, right?
It's always been that way. And like psychologists today call it confirmation bias, yeah, which you probably heard. But yeah, like we're biased towards like favoring a kind of viewpoint or perspective that makes us look good or feel good. And so we have to put ourselves in positions of discomfort where people can ask us questions that we don't like, and that might end up putting us in embarrassing situations or awkward situations. But we have to be a society that's comfortable with that. And you do this through early education and make questioning and being questioned about fundamental things just a part of our normal everyday conversations.
And I think, and you're much more the expert on this than me, but one of Socrates' most famous idioms, I guess, is that an unexamined life is not worth living. And I'm guessing that that's something with which you agree. But maybe you can talk about why that really folds into this whole topic of truth that we're focusing on this week, because I'm guessing it starts with just simply being truthful to ourselves.
Yeah. And so this idea of an examined life, you have to live an examined life in order to know yourself. If you don't know your own self, your own desires and fears and tendencies and the way they contribute to kind of shaping your views, then any kind of information you receive is going to be useless to you because it's always distorted by your perceptions. How do you live an examined life? Well, you engage in conversation with people who don't necessarily agree with you, right? And this is one of the real disservices social media has played, of like letting us kind of shape our audiences and having these algorithms kind of steer us towards things that we've liked in the past and kinds of conversations we've liked in the past. So we just keep getting confirmation of the things we've liked previously.
And like, in to defend these platforms, I mean, in some ways that's good. I mean, I'm a baseball fan, right? So I will see much more baseball content than someone who doesn't follow baseball. And like, that's probably fine, right? I don't care about hockey, so I'm not going to see much about hockey, and that's great. But you're not talking about, that's not really a danger, right? That I'm not somehow being shown, I'm not somehow appreciating hockey as the great sport it probably is. That's probably fine. But maybe you can explain why other parts of that algorithmic choices that affect us can be harmful.
Well, because you're right that like steering you towards something you like when you're going onto your phone and you're just looking for entertainment, mm-hmm. something like a pastime, and you just want to hear more about baseball
or see the highlight, the big home run from last night's game. That's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. But when politics is treated the same way,
yeah.
and the same algorithms are used, what happens is it turns politics into a spectator sport. And it's not a sport. It's not entertainment. We make decisions in politics that affect people's lives very deeply. In fact, vaccines, this has the potential of affecting millions of people's lives. That's not just a sport. That's not just a matter of cheering, hoping that our side wins. And yet, we can kind of see this. This is what's happened. Yeah, I mean, you go to town hall meetings right now, and like a lot of politicians won't give them because everybody goes to either boo or cheer. They're not going to the town hall meeting to ask questions and to hold people accountable. They're going to harass and to bully or to cheer them on, and it's like rugby matches.
And I'll give an example. As folks know here, I've spent a lot of time working at local newspapers in my career. And in one sort of underappreciated way, I think that newspapers have played a small role in this is as more of our audience has become digital, what we stress to editors across our company is if you're writing a story about your local government, about your state legislature, that, you know, throughout that story, at the end of that story, make sure you're always putting on related content that if you're reading about what the governor did yesterday, you might really care about what the governor did 3 days ago, or you might care about what the state legislature voted on last week or is working to vote on next month. And so we always say, find things that people will likely keep them on your site. But if you go back when newspapers were just newspapers, you would have a story about the state legislature, and maybe it would go from the cover, and as we say in the newspaper business, jump to page 7, and you finish reading the story on page 7. But then alongside that is a very unrelated story about maybe something happening in your state, maybe something happening across the world, but a good headline might catch your eye, and then you might find yourself reading about something you would never normally be interested or know that you were interested in. And I think that's just a really small example of how we sort of try to fine-tune our audiences, whether it's a newspaper company, whether it's, you know, large social platforms, that we try to keep people engaged by showing them things we think they already care about. And I think there's some sense to that. But again, I think people usually care about, even me, I care about more than just baseball.
You don't develop real interest in something without spending time with it. Like you have to invest some energy into any kind of subject in order for it to give that return. It's like you start to find it really interesting, unless you're just watching reels on Instagram or something, right? Like that's...
You mean 20 seconds isn't enough to become an expert on something, right?
Well, and this is the problem, is we're getting a population that's much less informed about serious matters, because serious matters are not as entertaining. Now, they can be deeply engaging, but you have to learn something about them for them to be engaging, and that takes time and it takes attention. And so what is it to live an examined life? Well, partly you have to develop the ability to really focus and give attention to things so that you can talk intelligibly with other people about significant matters and not just share things you either like or dislike. I mean, liking and disliking is a very kind of, I mean, it's one kind of reaction we have to things, but it's a very kind of primitive reaction, and it's not really suitable to the level of engagement we need to be participants in government, and that's what citizens are.
I want to pivot the discussion a little bit to something that's a little more in our everyday lives, and something you care and talk about a lot is our personal relationships. And I am quite confident there are many things I don't do well. But one thing I hope I think I do well is that I, and you may agree with this, you may not, but I don't think I am someone who just says nice things just because I'm trying to be a nice person. Like if I said, like if every time we got together to record this show, I said to you, oh my gosh, Rick, that is just, that shirt looks great on you. I think that it just makes you look 15 years younger. And I just think that's, you know, if I say that every time, your reaction appropriately would be like, well, whatever. I mean, Scott's just trying to be nice. Or
I would stop listening to it.
You would stop listening to it. Right. But like if today, and I'm not going to, and this is hypothetical, but I think your shirt today is very average.
Thank you, Scott.
But if I like said to you for the first time, my gosh, Rick, that is a really cool shirt you have on, or that's a really interesting sweater. I've never seen anything like that. Then you would probably be like, oh, huh. Well, Scott's never said anything about that before. And you might say, oh, I got this at an interesting store while I was traveling, or it was a gift from my somebody or other. And I sincerely believe that when you're more, you kind of, I guess I would like to hope, and again, it's hard to examine your own life sometimes, but I would like to hope that because of that, in my case, that those comments, as I'm not like handing out sort of like these compliments left and right all the time, that when they do come out, they're like more sincere. And in I think, I hope that's appreciated. Maybe it's not. But I guess that kind of brings me to the question, though, about like our everyday interactions. I mean, we all have times where people will ask us for feedback on a project they're working on at work, or what do you think of the shirt I just bought? Or, you know, my brother just opened a new restaurant and I know you were there last night. What did you think? I mean, we all have these times where we have to kind of balance truth with politeness. And that can also be sort of a tricky ethical situation to navigate, right?
Yeah, it is. But, you know, you said something at the very beginning, you know, like if you had been the person who just always complimented me no matter what, even if you didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would start ignoring what you said. So that's a very important observation about language in general, is that we use language to build a shared world that we can depend on. So that lying or deception has to be the exception to the rule. Otherwise, we stop using language. And we'll do this. We'll stop talking to people that we think are always lying to us. We'll stop using digital platforms that we think are unreliable, right? If we think that they're normally giving us misinformation, we stop using them and go to ones that we think are reliable. Even if we think they're occasionally wrong or occasionally see false things, like we want to be able to spot those exceptions. And it's interesting to note, by the way, that we have a verb for lying. We don't have a verb for telling the truth.
Huh. That's a good point.
And the reason is, like, telling the truth is the norm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And lying is the exception. So we have
a verb for murdering people. But we really have one for, like, keeping them alive.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good point. You know, it would be a strange society if the norm was lying. I think we would just stop talking to people altogether. This is a real danger, like of what's happening with misinformation. If we start to think that like everybody who's talking to us, say in government, everybody who's talking to us in the different institutions, they're just feeding us propaganda. They're just trying to tell us what they want us to think. We just start tuning them all out. I think to a large extent, this has already happened. And I'm really worried about that. And we can take guidance from what you point out, our interpersonal relationships. There are times where we kind of balance things like politeness or being kind or something. You don't want to be too brutal with facts, things like that. You can balance it out. But on the whole, to maintain the relationship, you have to be honest. Otherwise, there is no relationship there.
And as some people, and I certainly don't think you're one of these people, but we all know people who share lots of their life online. And I know people who will happily share, you know, great moments when, the, you know, we just went through first day of school things. And a lot of those pictures showed up on social media. And like, I think for most parents, that's a like a happy memory. And that's sort of like they can track their kid year to year and see them grow and all that's great. And you have these people who share things, those positive events. We also, I'm sure, in our circles have people who almost always seem to be sharing these low and awful points in their life. And in some people, unfortunately, have more low and awful points in their lives. Do you think truthfulness, though, requires us to be more fair, I guess, in sharing what our lives are like digitally in social media? I mean, if we're choosing to like share some things on social media, I'm saying this in a clunky way. Let's try it this way. We've all read situations, Instagram maybe is one, where young people especially continuously see all these beautiful people doing wonderful, exciting things that they can't afford or don't look the same way. And it builds up these unrealistic expectations. And oftentimes that's around like, you know, what are referred to as influencers or Hollywood stars or all that sort of stuff. But like regular people, do we maybe have a more of a responsibility to be a little more forthcoming and not just sharing the low points of our life or not sharing just the high points of our life, but showing a more balanced view? Or is that really not that important in the grand scheme of our lives?
I'd say it is really important. It's not the sort of thing that is, I don't think it's suitably shared on social media. And like, for one thing, you know, like social media is about getting clicks, you know, about like people like following, getting attention.
And whether you're selling a product or just like wanting to get something out in front of your 200 friends, you still want that attention. Otherwise, you wouldn't be sharing it.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be sharing it. And they wouldn't pay attention to it, right? It's all about getting attention. It has to be easy attention. Like, so like ordinary things that happen so that aren't going to come across. But when I go and see a friend and we go have coffee downtown and they ask me how things are going, and I might say, you know, yeah, I'm just kind of stuck in a rut. I've just been doing the same old things. There isn't anything really interesting happening. And then we can have a conversation about that. That's a really boring post to share.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily a boring conversation to have because, like, when you're sitting with friends, you care about one another. So the remedy for that is not posting differently on social media. The remedy is spending more time with real people. You remember Marshall McLuhan's book, The Medium is the Message?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was the title of the book or just the catchphrase that came out. But the medium really is the medium shapes the message. The social media format itself dictates that you're not going to get truthfulness in our conversations, in our representations of one another. And so if you want that, you've got to spend time with real people.
So my hope is that the people listening know that they're listening to a show called The Ethical Life. And because of that, are slightly self-selected in saying that, gosh, you know, I think truth is, in fact, important. I think Rick's right, that this is one of those things that you're talking about that really does build on the search for meaning. So if those people are listening and those people say, yeah, I value honesty, I value truth, and I want to do a better job of this in my personal life, whether it's work, it's at home, maybe it's online, is there something that you think you would want to leave people with, a message that says, I mean, everybody's different, right? But like an overarching theme that like how people could approach that or how people could maybe examine how they're living their lives now to be more truthful?
So I'm going to go right back to Socrates. I think, you know, for me, Socrates has been a really important guide for decades for me. And he says like one of the biggest temptations for being deceptive, both with others and to ourselves, is fear. We fear the consequences of different things. And we shouldn't. We shouldn't fear anything more than being a bad person, than doing things that harm others.
Or ourselves.
Or ourselves. And one of those things is just is lying. And so if we fear the consequences of lying more than we fear lying itself. We fear doing harm to others and to ourselves more than we fear the whatever the consequences might be of our words or something like that will be really helpful. And so Socrates says we should be fearless when it comes to telling the truth. We should just engage the world is what the world is, and we're much better off if we face it the way it really is. So ask questions about it, and don't worry about what will happen to me, what will happen to others if we just speak sincerely and forthrightly. Just make it a habit to live that way.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here is my question for you. And you'll probably guess by how this question is structured that this is exactly what happened to me just a couple of weeks ago. And I'll be curious to see what you would do in a similar circumstance. You and your wife spend 4 nights out of town at an Airbnb. The place is just as advertised, but you're surprised to see that there are baskets of snacks, a fridge filled with chilled drinks, and even some food in the cupboards. You had planned to go to the supermarket in that city to pick up some of these things, but now that they're already in the condo, do you simply enjoy those offerings instead?
It would depend a lot on whether I like them.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, clearly if I don't,
but,
you know,
well, I know
if it's a bunch of stuff you don't, but we'll assume that.
Yeah, let's assume it's stuff.
At least some of the stuff.
And some of the stuff is things I was planning to buy anyway. Yeah. And now here they are.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You would.
I would use them. And I would think this is one of the things I'm paying for.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, something like this happened to me. It was a couple of years ago, but I'd gone to I was on a trip and I'd rented this Airbnb that I was staying at for, I think it was 5 or 6 nights. And I'd stopped at a grocery store on the way there and picked up some groceries. And it was in a very small town that groceries are really expensive. And I had to buy things like butter, even though I'd used a little bit. I wanted some butter, you know, so I had to buy more than I need because you can't buy small enough amounts. And I get there and it had most of those things there. Probably from previous people who had gone and stocked it up.
And just left behind sticks of butter.
Yeah. And I felt bad for one thing. I'd wasted a bunch of money, but also it's wasteful,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you don't use those things, I assume they're either there because the host put them there for your use, and that's part of what you're paying for, or they were left by previous guests who had too much and had bought things and stocked it, one or the other. And,
yeah. In this case, it was a terrific Airbnb. The location was great. And this was sort of a surprise bonus. But you could tell by how these baskets were set up. There were three of them. And it was everything was very lined up. I think it was, I discovered that I had forgotten how much I like Nutter Butters, if you remember those.
Yes, I do.
But there was three of those next to three. And these were six in a package, right?
But these are highly arranged.
Yeah, and they're right next to the three Oreos, next to the three Chips Ahoy. And so it was not just, I think in the cupboard, I think there was a half-open bottle of olive oil that may or may not have, that I'm sure obviously stays there kind of a long time until it's empty and who knows. But I would say from the just by the way things were set up, this was 95% of things she provided. And I would imagine that whether it's online or at like one of those warehouse shopping clubs, you can probably go in and whether it's Nutter Butters or other things, buy like a large box of 3 dozen of these. And, you know, and when she or someone she pays refreshes the space, they're cleaning the bathroom, they're putting on clean sheets, and then they're also restocking the baskets. And I think what you're saying is that just like you're paying for clean sheets when you show up at this place, that sort of stitched into that price is all these other things. So I would tend to agree with you. I mean, I think we would agree, firstly, that it's probably if I like Nutter Butters and there's a couple of those, have at it. But if there were like a 3 dozen of those Nutter Butter packages, enjoying 2 while I'm there and taking 15 and sticking it in my bag so I can enjoy it at home is not really what it's supposed to be for, right?
Yeah, I think it's for your convenience and it's to make the stay a little more pleasant, right?
And I'll tell you, she had lots of positive reviews, maybe partially because of that.
But I assume you're also paying quite a bit for the place, and if you take the whole basket with you, it's not really cutting into the profits very much. Otherwise, they might do it less. There's kind of a general rule for any kind of behavior like this. Treat your host the same way you would want to be treated if you were the host. And so if you were doing something like that and you were putting things out for your guests, you might put out more than you think they need so that they would have a selection of different things.
Because not everybody likes Nutter Butters.
Right. But you're not putting it out so that they can stuff their duffel bag on their way out the door. That's not what you're doing it for. And if everybody was doing that, you would quickly probably start putting out less.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's not what you want either. Yeah, I mean, you're kind of appreciative. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so enjoy it in moderation, I would say.
And it was Travis and I had a little bit of a disagreement over it. I think I was more on your side. Again, I never for a minute thought we should empty pour every basket into our luggage and take it home. But like I assume that's the case. I mean, maybe it was things other guests left behind, but in the fridge was like probably 12 cans of assorted pop. There were some bottled waters, some with flavors. I mean, there was no alcoholic beverages, which is certainly understandable. But like we did have to go. We actually had friends over to this place and we made homemade pizza. And obviously there was not, you know, all the ingredients for homemade pizza. That would be kind of weird. But so we did go out and have to get like, you know, pizza crust and pizza sauce and pepperoni and all those things that start with B. And but like the discussion kind of came around to the fact of, well, we did buy, I think, like a 6-pack of beer, but like, what if people don't want beer? Well, I said, well, we have like these 12 cans of assorted pop in the fridge. That seems like enough. And he kind of felt guilty about like using some of that. I'm like, well, I mean, that's what it's there for.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think we did. We did not buy anything. And I think we probably that night there were 2 fewer cans in the fridge than the start of the night. So, I mean, it was not a big deal. So I tend to agree with you that this is just sort of part of what you're paying for. And she has made the decision, I assume, that these perks either keep people coming back or keep her 5-star ranking pretty high up, which it was. And it's a business, I mean, she's not running this just to be a nice person, although she probably is a nice person. She's doing this to make some money, and that's great. But if at some point she comes to the conclusion that she's losing money on this, either A, she stops doing it, or B, raises the price on the whole unit. So I guess that gets to maybe 2 last questions. One, so let's say you're staying at this place for 4 nights like we did, and you see all this stuff that she puts out. But, you know, like I said, this is a lot of it's like, you know, I keep saying Nutter Butters, but a lot of it was like that, these little packaged little snacks and pop in the fridge. And obviously none of this is like fresh fruits and vegetables. I mean, we understand why that is. And let's just say that like none of these things are things you have any appeal to you at all. and you're much, and let's say you're either going to go out to eat or bring in fresh foods to cook on the in the kitchen of this place, does part of you think, gosh, I'm kind of overpaying because part of this is for people who just sort of like this garbage processed food, and I don't really feel like I should be paying for that? Is that something that would even enter your mind?
That's interesting. It probably wouldn't. I mean, because this is so normal. The garbage food, that like the highly processed snack foods, are so common. They're everywhere. And you can't hardly avoid them. I would just assume, yeah, that's the host is putting out what's typical, what a lot of people appreciate, and what's also fairly inexpensive and easy to put out. I mean, but it's just not something that I'm going to enjoy. I'm going to go to the grocery store and buy some fresh fruit or something to snack on.
In talking to some friends about this afterward, two of them were like legitimately warning me, saying, well, they've stayed in hotels, so that I think fewer hotels have this all the time, but it used to be a little more common in hotels. You'd have the mini bar, right? So you'd have these little bottles of bourbon and whiskey and stuff. And like they were, and maybe even some, snacks like.
And you get charged $15 for one of the drinks on the mini bar, or like $5-6 for a bottle of water.
Yeah. So a few of my friends were like, are you sure that this isn't something when you check out, there's going to be like, a $60 addition to your bill? And I'm like, no. I mean, I think she would have disclosed that. It would have been, it would have been in the reviews, certainly, right? That I just had, four cookies and surprise on the bill. So, I mean, I wasn't worried about that, but it is correct that some hotels do still do that. And some hotels, although this also is less common, but some hotels still put out those little bottles of shampoo and conditioner and lotion that used to be more common. My experience, at least, is that a lot of those, especially chain hotels, and even some of the nicer hotels, have converted those into these larger pumps on the wall, I think, for a couple of reasons. One, it's just easier to refill, probably cheaper to buy that product in bulk, and better for the environment that you're not creating these tiny little bottles that one person opens to wash their hair, and then you just throw the thing away because you can't reuse that.
Yeah, it's much harder to take those great big bottles of shampoo home with
that are stapled to the wall.
Yeah.
But like, I guess in the days where that was more common in hotels, did you ever, and again, hotels seem a little different because, like, if it's the Marriott, that's like a multinational corporation versus Betsy, who we stayed with.
Would I take those little bottles?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because they're not leaving a half-filled bottle out for somebody else.
But let's say it's a bottle you don't open.
Yeah, maybe or maybe not. It depends on if... like the little bottles of lotion, mm-hmm. I still appreciate that. They're really convenient for little travel lotion. So, yeah, if there's a travel bottle of lotion out there, I'll generally take that because I'm going to use it in the next few days.
But, like, never a towel or
nothing like that. I mean, those.
Yeah.
I mean, I just assume it's expected that the reason they're tiny little bottles is because most people take them. It's what they expect, and so it's part of the package. The towels are not. That's hotel property, and they expect that to stay. I will give you an example. This summer, when my wife and I were driving back to Wisconsin from Colorado, we like to take different routes at different times. We kind of took an angled route up through Nebraska into South Dakota and then across. We had stayed at an Airbnb that was an old farmhouse, right, kind of on the Nebraska-South Dakota border, and it was way out in the country, and it wasn't like a 5-star type of property. It's just an old farmhouse, and we get in there, and there's this an old kitchen with a stove and refrigerator, and it's got a few things in the refrigerator like ketchup and mustard, so some of those condiments, And then in the cupboards, there's which we really appreciated. There's like a half open or half used package of coffee, some coffee filters, and there's a coffee pot on the counter. There's also some cooking oil and some popcorn. And these had all been opened. They're just partly used. But we really appreciated having, like being able to make popcorn that night.
Yeah.
Right. But we never thought, oh, we've got half a bottle of cooking oil that we can just take all. Yeah, yeah. Here's, you know, like a quart-sized jar of popcorn we can take home. We're thinking this is probably left there by guests. Maybe it was put out by the host for the guests to use, but it's put there to use appropriately, even though they were already opened. You know, it's not. We didn't think there was any danger in using it. And
popcorn kernels are pretty uncontaminated.
Yeah,
tough to contaminate.
But it's also there for us to use, but not to take. And so you usually can, a good rule of thumb is, what is the intention of the host in this case? And use your judgment on that. And I think you can't go wrong.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to check out Rick's column about truth and ethics. And that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I'm Scott Rotta. Thank you for listening.